Welcome to Headlines. This is David Lichtenstein here in the Yeshiva Shel Maila.
And this week we have a really important program. It's about talking to your children about the dangers in camp. And camp can be a wonderful experience, but you know, even the Ketores had something that wasn't so tasteful in it. And unfortunately, there are bad people, there are predators around. And we have a pretty big listenership, let's be honest. How many of you has your father ever, when you were a child, sat down and spoken to you about the dangers of molestation? In fact, raise your hand. Did any of your fathers ever sit down and have an honest conversation about anything that had to do with sexual matters? Or did we learn most of it either through friends or, if you're unfortunate, through a bad encounter? Well, let's try to avoid that, because now we live in a society where there is so much addiction, divorce, suicide, that according to both Tzvi Gluck, the tzaddik, who does work in it, or all the professionals, the Yankee Horowitzes, et cetera, they talk about the incredible damages that does to children at such an impressionable age that they very often never shake it for life. So we have a wonderful program with an incredible group. We have the honor of having with us the Poisik of Lakewood, the great Dayan, Reb Yankiv Forsheimer, first time he's ever been on our program, and he will be speaking about the chiyuv to speak to your children, the obligation to speak to your children. I know, stop cringing out there. I know these are things in yeshiva we never ever spoke about. We skip these things, but he says it's an obligation for a father to talk to his children. It could be life-saving. Right, we're going to have on one of the most famous doctors, the pediatrician, Dr. Shanik. Then we are going to have certainly one of the biggest goyim in America, the great Talmud Chacham Reb Aaron Sorsha. He's the father of a victim of camp abuse, and he will speak with feeling about the trauma that this creates. We will have Mrs. Debbie Fox, who speaks about nationally raising children, the importance of guiding our children through these issues. We will have Rabbi Y.Y. Rubinstein. He will speak about also the stories that happened to him, the experiences that he's had with children who were abused in camp. Dr. Hilton Lightman from the Five Towns. And then last, we will have the Psak, the great Psak from the Poisik, Reb David Cohn, who had the courage to speak about this and started a revolution. We had him on close to 3 years ago, and it's really that one Psak, I think it changed in America how we look at it, so we will replay that interview. So it's really, truly a great program. Before we go, I do always like to start with a vart on the Parsha. So here's my thoughts, and if you agree or disagree, I welcome all calls, and I remember, I don't consider myself a lecturer, a balmusa, a darshan, but I wasn't zeichet to be a magichi, I always wanted to in some way, so here in the yeshiva shomayla, but I certainly don't consider myself more learned, bigger Talmud Chacham, certainly not a bigger shamayim than you, my listener, so agree or disagree, but here's my vart. This week is Parshas Korach. And what is the story of Korach? It's a story, people say it's the parsha of Machlekes, that's true. But it's really the story of unhappiness. Korach was deeply unhappy with his lot in life. He wanted to be, like Rashi says, and not only him, but the Masayim, the Chamishim Eshdeh, Umavakshim Kahuna Gedayla, all 250 wanted to be the Kohen Gadol, according to Rashi. The Chazal, they all wanted to be holier. They wanted to be the Rebbe. They wanted to be the Rav, the Rosh Hashiva, the Mashpia, whatever it was. And they became deeply jealous of Moshe. And the jealousy created Machlekes. But we have to go to the root of it, which is jealousy. And what happens? Machlekes, some say they were Kaifer and Teres Moshe, the Rambam writes, etc. So what does he say? Moshe gives them a test. He says, Zaisasu, the following, Kichulachem Machtais, take, the copper shovels, Kairach v'chaladasai, v'tznu bohen eish, v'simu aleim k'tairas l'fnei Hashem. Rav Haya ish ha-shi'ivchar Hashem, hu ha-kadosh, the one who God chooses, he will be the kadosh. And what do? They did that. They put each one took a machtas of copper, And what happened? Moshe was mispal. He said to the Rabbeinu Shleilim, they all 250 took the Machteis, and Moshe was mispal. Im kemois kaladam yimusanela, ufkudas kaladam yipokeid, loy Hashem shlachani. And what happened? In Bria, so the earth opens up, it swallows them. And what happens? The shovels don't go into this chasm, right? Into the abyss. So the next day, Hashem says to Moshe, tell Elazar, he should take all these copper machdeis, and what should he do? He says, ki kodeshu, they are holy, these machdeis, even though they were doing it. They wanted to do it because they wanted. They were kairach v'adasai. He says, no, they're kadeshu. And what do you do with the machdeis? Take them and make the covering for the mizbeach hanechoshes with these machdeis. Now, kairach was, Tyra puts him as a really bad guy, right? I mean, dasan v'aviram, they were really bad guys. So what do? You put them as a tzipoy lamizbeach. Every time somebody brings a carbon, they're bringing the carbon on the copper of the shovels of Kairach v'adasai. I mean, this doesn't seem appropriate. It seems really, you know, very out of flavor, right? Tone deaf. Let me share with you. I think there's something very important here. Kairach was a really bad guy. Dasan v'aviram, the Masayim v'chamishamesh, they were chaylik and Moshe Rabbeinu, Moshe Reya Mehemna. But you know, they did have a good intent. They had a good intention. They wanted to be the Kohen Gadol. They wanted to serve. But they got very warped. The Negiyus came in. They didn't know boundaries. They didn't know the concept of Havdalah. Everybody has their job. I also wanted to sit and learn. I couldn't do it when I left yeshiva. We didn't have what to eat. I didn't want to take charity. I went to work, but I would have liked to, but they didn't recognize maybe this is your job, and they became very, very jealous. And jealousy, but there was an intent here that was l'shem shemayim. Madua tisnasu al kal Hashem. I want to be the Kohen Gadol. I want to be in the Lefnei Lefnim. So the Torah tells us something very powerful here, because as children, or certainly even adults, we're taught a very Manichaean idea. The world is black and white. There's good guys and there's bad guys. The good guys are going straight to heaven. The bad guys are going to Sheol Tachlis. There's no gray. But look at this. You take the machtos of these chaitim and you make the tzipi lamizbeach. You know why? Torah is telling us. There was something, they did have a holy thought. It's true there was a lot of bad. And if you had a holy thought, that part that's good of you has real meaning and will last forever. So they make it tzipui lamizbeach. The mizbeach is the makam avayid of Klal Yisrael. And every time somebody goes to bring a carbon, you know what the message is? Look, there's avayidah. But you see Kairach v'adasai? They had a good intention, but it has to be within boundaries. If it's within the boundaries that are accepted, that are appropriate boundaries, it's an avodah Torah. If not, there was some holiness there, but it wasn't the purest. We commemorate it, but it's not totally bad, right? It's certainly not. There's something holy there. And when I was a young boy, came back from Eretz Yisrael, my father took me to visit a Rosh Hashiva, an old Rosh Hashiva of Tarva Das. His name was Rav Pekarsky. And he told me, Yavart, and this is a long time ago, before most of you were born. And he told me, Yavart, and it still rings in my ear. I still remember he said it with such a slahavas. He said, in the Bayis Sheni, one of the Lishkas, in Yuma, I think it's on Daf Ches, says, was the Lishkas Parhedrin, and Stam Nusach is Palhedrin, and it's where they used to keep the Kohen Gadol for the 7 days before Yom Kippur, before he did the Avodah, Lefnayo Lefnim. So the Gemara says, why was it called Lishkas Palhedrin, or Parhedrin? It was named after those, the 70 Kohanim Gedolim in the Bayis Sheni, I don't remember the exact number, who they used to auction off the Kohuna Gedolah, and all of them wanted to go in and serve Lefnei Lefnim, and every year they died. They pulled them out by a cord. So he said it was named after those Kohanim who died Lefnei Lefnim. So Rav Pekarsky looks at me and he says, why would they name a Lishka in the Beis Hamikdash after the Kohanim who bought it, who then had to be pulled out by their leg. Like, what's the reason? They obviously they weren't the righteous Kohanim Gedolim. And he said, you know, every time they bought this, he said, the last 50 died. Are you sure, Mr. Friedman, Mr. Gross, Reb Aaron, Reb Moshe, Reb David, are you sure you want to buy this? And they would say, yes, I want to serve. I want to. And you know what? They would, and most often they would die. So Reb Karski looks at me and he says, you know, a person like this, even if he wasn't Roy, but he's willing to die for one moment of being Lefnaya Lefnim, he says, a tzaddik is an ishkeven, but for somebody like this, it's still worthy of naming a room in the Holy Beis HaMikdash. So these, yes, Koirach, Hadassah, they were really wrong, but you know what? There was something pure there, and for that we take their machdeis and we put them on the Makom HaAvodah of Klal Yisrael. And why do I say this? You know, here in this program we have lots of interesting people, some of whom I vehemently disagree with. You could think of in your life 100 examples of people you disagree with strongly, but you could still say, you know what, I think there is some element of truth here. Before we go to our guests, I like to announce two riddles. By the way, after the program, at the end, we will have the riddle winner of last week. But here are my two riddles for this week. This week in Parshas Truma, Pasuk Yud Ches Chazayin, it says, V'nechshav lachem trumaschem. So the Gemara in Shua says, because of V'nechshav lachem, it's Miloshin Machshava, that truma is nitla b'machshava, right? Look at Tosis over there, Divrei Maschil Mishum. You could just think something's truma and it becomes truma. So here's the question. By truma you make a bracha, right? L'hafrish truma, right? Even though it's pasul machshava. The question is that Shulchan Aruch and Aruch Chaim Simen Tov Lamed Brei says that you don't make a bracha on bittel chametz, even though it's a kiyum a mitzvah tashbisu. Why? Because you could do it belave. The ein mevarchen al dvarim shabalev. So the question is, by tashbisu that you could do belave, you don't make a bracha, because you don't make a bracha on something if I just think of it and it happens. And by truma, we have a pasuk that says, nechshav lachem trumaschem, and the halacha is, you make a bracha on a freshest truma. That is my riddle. What is the difference between truma and chametz? And I'll ask you a second riddle. For those who are ready have the answer, let me ask you another one. The Rambam in Perek Ches of Yisodei HaTorah Halacha Aleph says, Moshe, a famous Rambam, Moshe Rabbeinu, leheminu by Yisrael, ne oisei sha'asa. They didn't believe in him because of the oiseis. And he says, because a maimon al pi oiseis, she'll believe by daifi. He says, all the oiseis that Moshe did were not to believe in him, but lefi hatzayra chasan, he only did them because he had to, not to, as a display. Loi lahavi raya la nevua, when he had to bury the mitzrim karas hayam, he had to make mazayin harid lanu asaman, it wasn't so you should believe in him. Tzamu bakulam esavin, kafru bayadas kairach, he had no choice. They were rebellion. He had to swallow up the land. The chayin shar kalal oisus. So the Rambam says that opening the earth by Kairach wasn't for Nevua, the Chazik HaNevua, only to punish Kairach v'noyedim imay. Precious, the Rambam's going against a Beferish Pasuk. Where's the Pasuk says? Bezois teidun ki Hashem shlachani. With this you will know. I will prove it to you. How? In Briya Yivra Adamo, Patsasas Pia. It's a Beferish Pasuk, neged the Rambam in Hilchos Yisodei HaTorah. Those are our two riddles for the week. Next week, we will announce the winner.
We have the honor of having with us on the phone Hagoyin Rav Yaakov Forsheimer, who is the Paisik of Lakewood, of Beis Medrash Gevoya. It's an honor to have you on with us, Rabbi Forsheimer. Rabbi Forsheimer, it's camp season, and people are sending their children to camp. So some people believe, it's been discussed, that before you send a child to camp, you should have a discussion with him about, you know, Dvarim Shebet Sinna, what happens if somebody approaches you or tries to touch you inappropriately, etc. And then there are parents, certainly Hasidish people, who say, you know, you can't talk about these Dvarim Shebet Kedusha, and why open up a child's eyes to things he doesn't know about, and therefore the safety of the child comes second to the concept of Tznius. what would the great Dayan of Lakewood advise in this matter?
Halach is to, yes, discuss it with the children. Don't elaborate about it, but tell them that anybody touch them inappropriately, meaning in a way that makes them feel uncomfortable, then they should immediately call up their parents and go to a adult staff member and report it immediately. Now, they should be...
I'm sorry, when the Rav says inappropriately, like, what would that mean? How would you say that to a child?
That means in places that make him feel uncomfortable.
Okay. Now, would the Rav say that this is... Is this obligatory on a parent, or is it you want to be a better parent? Like, how strong of a chiyuv is it to talk to your children about this? Whereas the Gemara says, "Hai v'adam lamed b'nei Torah la'asiyah isha la'asita b'nar." Would you say this is a mitzvah? Like, try to give us a little bit from a halachic perspective. How strong do you feel about this?
Well, a person, I mean, unfortunately, in the age we're living in, where there are a number of molesters around, all different places. For example, even in yeshiva dormitories, sometimes it could be in buses, it could be pretty much any place. Unfortunately, even in a home sometimes, depending who's there, of course. So it's good that a child should know that they're being touched in a place that, which makes them uncomfortable. They should immediately report it to their parents, and if it's in camp and to an adult staff member, if it's in yeshiva, an challah member. And it's very important because, unfortunately, the outcomes of being molested could be terrible. For example, I was told of cases where children never even committed suicide at the end because they felt they were violated and they went so far. I know of numerous cases where, unfortunately, shortly after Chasna, Gittin were written because of the result of the victims of molestation. So there's not an issue that could just be taken lightly because the ramifications of Chasna would be terrible. Of course, if something does happen and the parents are consulted, then they have to do what they have to do. I mean, the child would probably need professional help. They speak to a pediatrician or somebody who knows the parsha well and how to go about it. Because often, through professional help, they could be treated, and when they get older, it would not affect them as badly as if they were not treated. Untreated could have terrible results. And if treated properly, often the results are more positive. So it's proper to speak to a pediatrician or another knowledgeable person to guide you as to what kind of professional help the child should get. Also, it's important for the camp staff. It's also important for the camp staff to know how to conduct themselves and make policies to help the children. For example, the director, head counselor, whoever's in charge, should tell the counselors and the other staff members about the importance of protecting the children from molestation. Now, another thing would be bullying. Like sometimes, unfortunately, the children like to bully around other children. They're also, if the child feels being bullied, straight away call up his parents and speak to an adult staff member of the camp and take care of whatever could be taken care of, which should be taken care of in the camp, of course, but also tell the parents. The parents in camp should work together on this. Now, children need emotional support from their parents. They have to feel that the parents are validating them. They have to feel that the parents are there for them, to help them. There's a certain sense of security children have with their parents. And very important that the parents should act in such a way that the children feel that they have parents that are supporting them, they're validating their concerns, and they have a security in that. The truth is, this is important for everything, not only in the area of molestation. It's important for the whole chinuch of a child, the whole upbringing of a child. That child should feel that the parents are there for them. Like this, is the more times a parent spends with a child, the more success they're going to have in the chinuch. Because the more they show the child they're being there for them, the more the child will trust them. Then also, when a child comes home from camp, it's good to pass ask them, how was this camp? How do you like it? How did everything work out? And see how everything was.
I'm curious, can I ask the Rav, why isn't this addressed in the Gemara at all? Like, it seems so important, and you don't see it, like, sort of in the Shulchan Aruch and the Paiskim. Does it fall under the fifth Shulchan Aruch? It's something so critical, and we don't find it anywhere. Has the world changed?
Unfortunately, things have changed a lot. Like, as time is going on, it's getting worse and worse, unfortunately. And people have to put an end to this.
Yeah. And I would ask the Rav, how does one broach this with a child in a way that does both, it doesn't violate the child's kedusha, in other words, it doesn't, you're not opening his eyes too much, and on the other hand, make it friendly enough so that the child actually does feel like have the confidence to approach their parents. Like, it's sort of like there's a tension between the two, being explicit, being not explicit in a friendly manner, not in a friendly manner. How would the Rav say to do this?
I'd say that, like I mentioned earlier, first of all, there should be a lot of open talk between parents and children, namely that the children should be very comfortable talking to the parents, and that's in the hand of the parents, how they talk to their children. They always say, I'm too busy now, not now, I'm on the phone, not like that. Then, of course, it's going to lead to bad things. Parents show the children that they have time for them, and they want to have time for them, and they're there for them. Like this, they could build up a good relationship, and then the children will be makabel much better from the parents. So therefore, the parents will tell them, like if somebody touches you in an uncomfortable manner, right away call us, we're here to help you. Then the child will feel more at ease. He'll feel that he has parents that he can rely on and they're out to help him. Then he will report back to his parents. And also he should report to a staff member. Like this, something could be done about it. But it's important that there should be discussions between parents and children. Like I mentioned earlier, not only for this, but for everything. But this is one of the areas which is very important that there should be a lot of open talk between parents and children, and the children should feel that the parents are validating what they have to say, and they should feel that they're comfortable with their parents. The parents are there for them. And also the parents give a lot of emotional support to children, chas v'shalom, something happens, children know that their parents are there for them and they'll support them, they'll be comfortable talking to their parents. Like this, a lot could be avoided ahead of time. Because if something chas v'shalom happens, they have to immediately call the parents and the parents have to take action. But the best thing is to avoid it in the beginning, that if everybody's careful with it, and soon something happens, children will call the parents and go to the staff, then, of course, it's probable that nothing will continue. Things will end right then and there.
Rabbi Forsheimer, would you say this is just for camp, or would you say it affects all areas of life, in yeshiva, in shul, in the playground, etc.?
Unfortunately, I've heard cases in all areas, all places, unfortunately. But now that the camp season, it's a good way, it's a good excuse, so to say, to mention it to the children.
Rabbi Forsheimer, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
Alter.
Our next caller is Dr. Reuven Shanik, the famous pediatrician.
Hello, my name is Dr. Reuven Shanik, a pediatrician in Lakewood. I wanted to join the Gedolim, Rabbanim, and professionals urging parents to speak to their children about summer safety before sending them to camp. Summer is a time that can make or break a child. Let us tell our children before camp that if anyone does anything that makes them feel uncomfortable, they need to tell us or a trusted adult right away. A child needs to know that they can always speak to us as parents and that we will always listen to them and believe them. We need to tell them before camp that summer can be enjoyable and pleasant when we follow simple rules of safety. And when a child is abused, chas v'shalom, it breaks the child, sometimes even leading to suicide and major problems. As a pediatrician, I feel it's important to let our children know that there's appropriate touch and there's inappropriate touch. In fact, you should have a conversation with your children every once in a while, or your children, about not letting anyone touch their private areas, not to take rides from strangers, not to speak to people they don't know. If anything like that happens, you should tell your parents right away. So if anyone touches their children inappropriately or makes them feel uncomfortable, they should follow the Lamed rule. Lamed for low, Lamed for love ruach, Lamed for lasaper.
Meaning?
Yell no. run away, and tell us or a trusted adult. Let us speak to our children before camp, and may Hashem grant us all a happy, safe, and enjoyable summer, filled with much bracha, nachas, gesund, and happiness. Thank you.
We have on the phone with us, formerly the Rav of Whispering Pines in Lakewood. Today, he's the Maggid Shir of Shas Illuminated, Harav Rav Aaron Sorsha. Welcome, Rav Aaron.
Yes, thank you, Rav Aaron.
So, Rav Aaron, we're discussing an issue which is very prevalent, I shouldn't say very prevalent, but it's unfortunately somewhat prevalent in our community, where we have predators, and they prey on us, either financially or on our children, etc. And the question is, how to deal with these people? Now, I think you're somewhat in an ironic situation, because a member of your family was a victim of a predator, and I understand that you did what you could to address these issues and try to remove the predator from the community. And you were somewhat in the unusual situation where it seems you were uncomfortable and left the community, even though your family was in effect the victim here. Could you give us a little color on both from a personal or maybe from a hashkaf or halachic view of how you would deal with this as both a Rav and a very big Talmud Chacham?
Yeah, well, in my case, it's true. A son of mine, we had learned, was a victim of sexual abuse by someone who was a camp counselor of his. The first thing that I did was I actually confronted him directly, and my message to him was that I'm not out to destroy him, I'm not out to hurt him, but we have a responsibility, both of us, that this doesn't happen again. And in order to work that out, the only possible way is that he should leave his job. He was a teacher in a school, and he was a counselor in camp, and also get help, get therapy. And I wanted to direct him to where he could get that help. Initially, he was cooperative. He didn't deny anything. He admitted it to me and to the rabbanim that I brought him to, and to the professionals that I brought him to. And I was under the impression that this situation was at least somewhat resolved. Subsequently...
Wait, let me interrupt you. Why did you feel the responsibility to remove him from the community? I know it may sound like a sort of a silly question, but I'm asking you both from a halacha, a hashkafa, from a neighborhood. Why would you say that?
Because sexual abuse is very, very damaging to the children. It's always a very big trauma. It could lead even to suicide. It could definitely lead to drug abuse, which also could be a clear pikuach nefesh question because of drug overdose. And drug abuse anyway is, as we all know, it's extremely damaging. Even without that, it leads to spiritual alienation. Many children who went off the derech was a direct result of sexual abuse. It does lead to failed marriages, and it's definitely something which the victim has to deal with usually for the rest of their life. Now, I don't mean to stigmatize the victims. It's definitely possible that with help and with encouragement, the victim could recover from it and could be a very fine, productive, firm individual. But the damage is immense, and there's very rarely such a thing as one victim. If someone was involved in sexual abuse with one child, all the children that he is in contact with are at risk. And it was partially Samad Adam Riecha to do something. I believed, maybe I'm a bit naive and optimistic, I believed that by speaking to him, because I knew the perpetrator, and other than this tremendous problem he had, he did seem to me like somebody who I could work with, someone who is, if you could call him that, essentially a good person who means well, but he's just completely, you know, his compulsive behavior, completely under the control of the Yetzirah. Initially, he did give me that impression, too. He expressed a lot of remorse and basically acknowledged that he has a big problem and did sincerely want to get help for it. It's just he backed out. He backed out because there were people that gave him very bad advice. There were people that he protested his innocence to and And strangely enough, they just took his word for it without asking me, without asking the people he was dealing with, or if they did ask other people he was dealing with, they apparently ignored him. He admitted the whole thing. It didn't make any sense at all. But after a while, after a few months, he was very brazen. He refused to give up his jobs. He refused to do anything that we asked. I sent a message to him. I didn't want to talk to him again because he didn't want to talk to me. I sent a message that I'm going to have to go to the authorities. When the message was ignored, someone else tried to work with him. Whatever the case was, about a month later, I went to the prosecutor's office and they arrested him. Subsequently, there were people in the community that agitated and that didn't rest and did a tremendous amount, you know, put a tremendous amount of time and effort into a campaign, basically to both come with a two-pronged attack, that A, there's absolutely no evidence that he did it, and it's just, you know, the whole thing is crazy, and B, even had he been a molester, this is not the appropriate way of dealing with it.
So they made your life difficult.
Yeah, but I didn't engage with them at all. And that's the way it was. And we did end up moving from Lakewood. But it would not have been a problem for me to stay there. It's just that there were members of my family that, because of the treatment they had by certain individuals in Lakewood, they just didn't feel comfortable being in Lakewood anymore. They still don't. And we moved.
When somebody reports somebody to a prosecutor, somebody who's been this firsthand, does the prosecutor say, okay, you said it, I'm arresting, I'm convicting? Or before they arrest, is there a thorough...
Well, the prosecutor will definitely investigate. At least the prosecutors are trained in talking to the victim and understanding if the victim is credible. I can't say that any time there's arrest that's for sure. You could already assume that the person's guilty. That's not true. But it's not, the arrest is usually not made just on a whim, just on a, usually there is, there's definitely some investigation that's done beforehand.
From Los Angeles, California, we have Mrs. Debbie Fox, a renowned expert in child rearing, psychology, etc. Welcome, Mrs. Fox.
Hi, good morning. Thank you.
Good morning. So can you tell us, give our listeners a primer as somebody who's been working with children for decades. How do you, you know, inculcate your child against a possible misfortune event at a camp? What would you tell them?
So I would say it's kind of four steps that parents really need to take. The first one is before camp starts, and I think that parents don't take their power. If parents all stood up and actually communicated with camps in advance and let camps know, I want to know what your policies are in camp in reference to Safe Touch. I want to know what your supervision policies are. What is your training that you give to your counselors? What is the training you give to your head counselors in order to prevent abuse in camp? If people really stood up and said, these are the things we require in order to send our camps, I think camps would have no choice, all camps would have no choice, but to have conduct policies for all their counselors that they have to sign and to make sure that the counselors themselves are safe and the camp environment is better supervised and all of that. I think camps would have to follow through.
You're saying that ultimately the parents are the clients and the customers, and a camp, just like any other business, will respond to the requests of its customers. So if parents just say nicely to the camp, we would like to see a copy of your policies of, you know, of how to deal with a situation of inappropriate behavior, and what is your education on it, that would bring Brits to the forefront of the awareness on behalf of the camps. And probably schools as well. Does it make sense for schools to have a written policy how we deal with, you know, allegations of abuse or molestation?
Many do have a policy, and there are more and more schools that are developing them. And I agree with you so much in what you just said. This is about several months before camp, when you're deciding on camp, to have that friendly conversation that lets them know I'm a concerned parent and this is what I require. But it shouldn't be adversarial. It should be that these are what we require as parents. And many camps do have them. Many do. Many have policies. Many have trainings. And many have really good supervision at night. But how do you know if you haven't asked?
Okay, very, very valid point. Let's hear your next point.
My next point would really be everybody's responsible to prepare their own child. Really, I would really say that the single most important tool towards protecting any child from sexual abuse is their relationship with their parent and a parent's ability to talk to a child. This is a parent's responsibility to bring it up. And my belief is that it shouldn't just be a quick conversation before they go to camp. It has to be ongoing. It has to be something that starts when they're little, when they're in a bath. Kids don't do so well with the conversation, the biggie. They do better when it's ongoing. Every parent has to be that parent that the kid can talk to. That parent that the kid would say, you know what, that's a question. Somebody just brought that up. I don't know what that's about. I'm going to ask my mom. My mom's the one who's going to tell me. And so I think every parent has to attempt to be that parent. So you have to have natural conversations. Choose a window of opportunity. You're looking for a bathing suit with your child. And you say, you know, we haven't talked about camp safety yet, have we? Let's sit down and talk about it. It just brings it up for me because everything under your bathing suit is private. And that's going to apply at camp, too. Let's talk about what some of those situations might be.
You're saying, just like in business, a good manager doesn't wake up one day and say, how am I going to save money today? But it's an ongoing thing. Or in a good relationship, a husband doesn't one day say, today is going to be the day I treat my wife properly. You said the same thing about educating about molestation abuse. It should be an ongoing conversation that happens over the course of a child's lifetime.
Yes. As they grow developmentally, situations are going to be very different. Boys going to camp may deal with things like other boys pulling their bathing suits off in a pool. There may be issues with showering and changing, you know, grooming relationships, making sure that they don't have special relationships with people, which precedes molestation. You know, those are all things that there are natural ways to talk about with kids. That touch
now, Mrs.
is
Fox,
never...
question for you. My mother actually asked me this question yesterday. She said, how come we never heard about this when I was young? My mother said, is the world changing or is it just not becoming more enlightened and more aware?
It's a really good question. What I am going to say is that I give parent workshops on sexual abuse prevention all over the country. And whenever I finish, there is a long line. And almost everybody in that long line is coming with a disclosure. And that disclosure is what happened to them when they were young. So I don't think it didn't happen. I think we didn't talk about it.
Okay. What's your third point, Mrs. Fox?
My third point is that before your child goes to camp, it's the parent's responsibility to figure out, in case anything happens in camp that their child's even uncomfortable with, a relationship they're uncomfortable with, some way someone's looking at them, someone's starting to touch them, or even if they see something, going on between two other kids or a counselor and a child, that they need to have somebody that you've helped them identify before they go that is a trusted adult in camp. And you have to let them know, if anything ever comes up, I want you to go to this head counselor. I've talked to them, or to this nurse, or to whoever. They're there. And until you can reach me, that's a person for you to talk to. So that's
it can't just be a theoretical thing. If this happens, then you should be aware. Well, what do you do with the awareness? You're saying it has to be actionable. If this happens, this is the name of the person. It's Mrs. Fox you're going to go to. It's Reuven, Shimon Levy. Identify a person. Have a conversation with that person in advance. Maybe that person should introduce themselves to the child. Maybe somebody the child knows and say, hi, your mother said if something happens, I'm going to be the person you speak to.
Yes, because as adults, when we're in crisis, when we're scared, it's very hard to think of the right person to go to. We freeze. So certainly kids don't know that. Identify it for them. Even if they're uncomfortable, they don't have to wait for something to happen.
Right. You're saying hachana is the most important thing. Being prepared in advance is the most important thing.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm. And lastly, I would just say is that parents really need to be aware when their children get home. So often kids will say, I got home from 4 weeks of camp or 8 weeks of camp. Mom said, how was camp? I said, great. She said, great. What do you want for breakfast? And that was the end of the conversation about camp. If you want to know how camp is, open the conversation, discuss it with them, find out which activities they liked, find out who was in their bunk, talk to them openly and have a lot more conversation. Pay attention to whether the child you sent to camp is the same child as the child who's coming home from camp. Are there any dramatic changes in behaviors? I once had a mom call me. She called maybe in February, and she was talking about her daughter. And she said to me, the daughter that I sent to camp was not the daughter that came home from camp. But she didn't realize that until February. That's a long time for a child to suffer. If you see dramatic differences, you have questions to ask or to get that child an assessment. That's really important that a parent notice the differences. And if a child does disclose something, if a child says somebody was inappropriate with them, I would just say really, really quickly that the first and foremost thing a parent needs to do is just remain calm. Don't get hysterical. Be really calm so their child can see that my parent can handle it and I can trust them and I can talk to them. The parent needs to just receive the information calmly, needs to say, thank you for sharing with me. It means a lot to me. I'm glad you trusted me. I'm going to help you. And don't pry too much into the details. The details will come out. But just stay calm, receive, thank them for trusting you. Make sure you let them know they're doing the right thing by telling you. The child won't be in trouble for telling. So those are some important messages if a child does disclose. And then the parent has to act on it. They have to figure out what did happen, and they have to be willing to stand up for their child.
Here is Rabbi Y.Y. Rubinstein, the famous English lecturer, worldwide famous. He's going to speak about the middle of an interview. He's speaking about an event that happened in camp.
Well, the fourth one is the one that we really don't want to talk about, but actually, in Kol HaKavod to the From World, I never thought they would talk about this, but now we are. And when I published this piece, which started off, as I said, in Hamadiyah, I had a phone call from a lady who would not give her name. And you realize when rabbis are phoned by people with problems who won't share their name, that it's obviously a very deep problem. She said, you wrote about three reasons why kids got the Derech Rabbi, there's a fourth. And she paused, and I said, oh, you mean sexual abuse? And then I heard a little noise in the background. She said, I'm a survivor. And this woman came from a very prestigious home, a Hasidic home in this particular case, although it doesn't have to be. And she was, I don't know the age group of the people listening to your show, but she suffered the worst at the hands of her father, if you follow. And this lady gets Shiurim. They now live in Eretz Yisrael. Her husband is a Magid Shir. The damage that is done. Now, what is the instance? What's the statistic of the phenomenon we're talking about? So I have a relation through marriage who's called Rabbi Dr. Shimon Russell, who lived in Lakewood till very recently. He's moved to Israel. And somebody called Rabbi David Revson, who is, I think, one of the cleverest and certainly straightest men in the world. And he is, the number of Meistus Habonas that he's created is enormous, from Neve through the whole spectrum. Both came up with the exact same figure. Girls going off the Derech, 85% have been sexually abused.
85%. And boys?
Boys, I'm not sure. It's not far off it. And it's normally, I'm going to say something which is going to be extraordinarily unpopular with your listeners. And maybe it's because I'm British. I was told by both, most of the abuse that happens to boys is not the Rebbe, etc., although that is obviously headline and horrible. It often takes place by other boys, and particularly at the most ridiculous institution I know of in the world called summer camp. The American summer camp. Just send your kids away for 6 weeks or 2 months in the summer away from you with counselors who are maybe 2 years older than the kids, and they'll have a great time. If I was the Sultan and I wanted to get the kids, I could not have dreamt up a better model than the summer camp model.
Wow. Everybody, you've heard it here first. Rabbi Y.Y. Rubenstein, summer camps are very dangerous. It's not just sending your kids away to Eretz Yisrael when they're 20 or 18 for a few years. Sending a 6, 7, 8, 9, 10-year-old away to summer camp can be really dangerous.
Yes, yes. I'll tell you an interesting story. As I mentioned before, my late wife died from cancer. And so I had two doctors at the time. One was, I'm trying to get the ages right, I think one was 12 and one was 14, something like that. And I was doing lecture. I was still living in England, and I was lecturing over America. And somebody recommended a summer camp. I won't say which one. And I asked friends, good, really good people, who themselves had gone to this camp when they were young ladies. And they said it was great. Ramatisio afterwards told me I was completely wrong. It was not a great camp. I should have asked him before, of course, but I just trusted the other people. And, of course, things change and things evolve, and something that had a great reputation and was a good place might no longer be so. Anyway, my daughter, because her mother had died, was put in a bunk with other troubled girls. But troubled girls in this case meant drugs, sexual activity, etc., etc. Nothing wrong with my daughter, nothing wrong with her Jewishness, her Yiddishkeit. But before we get to the effects of the other kids on the administration of this camp, which is a well-known camp, there's another response, incidentally, which if you'll allow me to make. When I was in England, I fought and battled very, very hard for a number of years to expose somebody who was a fraud, a phony, and probably a pedophile. Probably. I couldn't get enough evidence. But he was certainly a liar and a fraud and had forged his qualifications but got involved in chinuch. Well, pedophiles wouldn't they? Etc., etc. Anyway, in confronting people who had been fooled by this person, I found over and over and over again, despite offering them the evidence, that when you show them that they should have done the due diligence, they should have checked this guy out and didn't, they are appalled for 24 hours. And then they immediately go into defense, self-defense, and therefore defense of the person. They become complicit in the crime to cover up their own lack of responsible inquiry to make sure that the guy was appropriate before they appointed him. And to this day, that phenomenon still occurs. So I certainly know of a couple of frauds and phonies who I've dealt with and come across here in the United States, and who are dealing with people. But the problem is, if I say, you know, Rabbi this, the guy you think who is Rabbi this is not, he's a fraud, the strange thing is people don't listen. And then you just become known as a troublemaker, and you just opened up a war, which you're going to lose because I don't know why, people won't listen. Maybe it's because they're embarrassed because they should have listened a long time ago.
We have on this phone with us from the Five Towns, Dr. Hilton Lightman, originally of South Africa, a physician, a pediatric physician. He was a camp doctor both at Benos and Aguda, so he's certainly an expert in the dangers or the things you need. I need precaution when you send a child to camp. Welcome, Dr. Lightman.
Hi, thank you.
Dr. Lightman, if you had to give a brief primer to parents and saying you're sending your kids to camp, you want to keep them safe, well, here are a number of things that you should be very aware of. Somebody who has experience directly in this area, what would the primer look like?
Okay, namely, you want your kids to have a successful and happy summer. So they have to be aware of, there are certain pitfalls that can occur during camping. And when one approaches it, you should say to the kids, look, you're going to have a great time. We're going to miss you. Have fun. You're going to have lots of friends. But there's certain things that we want you to do. Number one, you should still continue your body hygiene because you might get wet in camp and you want to change your socks regularly, change your underwear so they shouldn't get any infections in their feet, because that's very important, not to get any fungal infections in the toes because that can spread. And then in that way, you can go into other topics. Make sure you're drinking enough water there, not to drink carbonated sodas, especially the sugar sodas, because that can dehydrate the child. and make sure that the camp does have water fountains and water coolers, and they're not just giving juice all the time to the kids because that's not the best thing for them. And then to the kids, you're outdoors, you be careful, there's a lot of mosquitoes, there can be bugs. We're going to send you some sprays, for example, as off, that you can spray into your clothes, that you shouldn't get bitten, because when you sweat a lot and they get bitten by mosquitoes, they can then become secondary infected and get a cellulitis. And you tell the kids, you know, it's very important to drink a lot of water, as well as keeping yourself clean, brush your teeth. And then you go on to the topics of saying, you know, boys, when you're older, you might be friends there. They're going to give you things to drink. You might go give you a beer. If you're underage, you shouldn't be drinking. And don't drink anything that someone's given to you that you don't know what's inside, especially the older boys, because there might be alcohol. And alcohol in camps is illicit, but it is done behind the scenes. When people aren't aware of it, they can sneak out to the local supermarkets and bring back vodka, which looks like water. And the kids will drink that, and if they're drinking and driving in the mountains, unfortunately, Loleni, there shouldn't be any accidents, which there are every year, because people don't know the mountain roads, and especially if they're inebriated, that's inappropriate. The other thing is for the parents themselves to be aware of, that when you send your child to camp, please notify the camp if there are any problems with your child, if there are any illnesses, if there are any medications. And especially if everybody's worried about the almighty shidduch, they tend to forget about putting all these symptoms down, all these comments. So there should be a little box that's checked off confidential. Please get the nurse to call me, and we will then discuss the issues and say, yes, my child has, God forbid, has had seizures, and they're on medication. Because many times kids would come to camp, they wouldn't take the medication, or the staff didn't know about it, and the child would have a seizure, and we'd rush to the hospital, and then we'd find out that really they did have a history of seizures and they weren't taking medications. So there's no booster whatsoever. It's for the safety of a child. If a child does have seizures, we've got to be precautions. They shouldn't be left alone in the swimming pool. They shouldn't be left alone in their bunkhouse in case, God forbid, something can happen. So it's nothing to be worried about, to be embarrassed about, but you must notify the camp and the staff as to what medications the kids are. Now, many times kids are on ADD medication during the year and they're taken off in the summer, and those children can have a rebound and can be much more impulsive or aggressive or have irritability when they're at camp. And if the camp is aware of it, that, you know, my kid was on this medication, they're not now, then they have methods of looking after those children, of making sure there's boundaries and structures and preventing them from having any.
Dr. Lightman, could you share with us a story of an example of what happened when a parent that you experienced did not notify the camp about a child's medications, et cetera?
Okay, so we once had two interesting cases. One was a young lady was in a camp, and the fellow bunkers were very nervous and agitated because she was jumping from the top bunk to the next bunk, saying that she's a bird, that she's flying. And it was very perturbing to see this. We thought, well, is she having some type of mental breakdown? Is there some type of psychological issue? What's going on? And then when we inquired, we found that she had been on medication for psychiatric issues that the parents had stopped because she was going to camp. And this had a tremendous rebound, and this kid was now isolated herself. She made herself look very silly in the eyes of her fellow campers, and she became labeled, which was quite tragic for her. Instead of having a wonderful summer, she started off looking rather foolish. And once we gave her the medication, the rest of her summer was wonderful. Another one is we had to take the kid to the local hospital, and unfortunately, although they're called regional center hospitals, they are not of the quality that we have in New York City. And the child had a massive seizure. She was unconscious. We had to give her life support and rush her to the hospital. And when we were there, we then found out afterwards that she did have a history of seizures and she hadn't been on medication while she was in the summer. And the mother had just told the counselor, by the way, my daughter gets migraine headaches. So if she starts having a headache, leave her alone in her bunkhouse and then she'll be fine. And that was totally inappropriate. This kid could have been in the swimming pool. The counselor was going to leave her alone in the bunkhouse because she said she had a headache, but fortunately she did not. And the child had a massive seizure, and we had to take her to the hospital. And we were not too happy with the family because they put their child at risk.
Okay, so I'm sorry for interrupting your flow. So you spoke about hygiene, you spoke about physical health, about mental health, and sharing with the camp. What else would you tell parents?
And I think it's very important for the parents not to induce anxiety in the kids, but they have to explain that they're going to be in close quarters with other children, with madrichim, with counselors, and it's important to learn how to behave and what not to do to somebody else and not to have anything done to themselves. Namely, that there's a concept of tznius, and it shouldn't be done in a way that the kid gets anxious and worried and thinks that everything's negative, but you tell them according to the age of the child. So the younger child, you explain, you know, when you go into the shower or the bathroom, do not go alone, do not go with more than with any one person, go in a group, see what's happening. You have to realize your body belongs to you, it's Hashem's creation, and that nobody is allowed to invade your privacy. And the same thing with the older child, you can get into more specifics that there's such a thing called inappropriate looking and inappropriate touching. And the tragedy is, in the old days, we'd say to a kid, you know, no one's allowed to touch you. Now it's changed, and you have to say, and they can't say to you, I'm not allowed to touch you, but you can touch me, which is the way the world has gone, that we're not, unfortunately, we're not immune to anything. All the wiles and mashugasim of the rest of the world has permeated Klal Yisrael, be it to a lower degree, but it does exist.
Can you share with us a story, Dr. Lightman, of something that when obviously you, without mentioning names or places, what you've seen in camp in this area?
Okay, so it was in a Hasidic camp where I got a call where a ex-camper who was now much older had come into the camp at 2 in the morning and had molested 2 14-year-old boys. And the camp was very agitated that they didn't want this to be leaked out, nor did they allow the 2 boys to go for therapy. And that's when there was a big argument, because one of the parents had called me and I told them that child does have to go talk to a therapist. They have to understand it was not their fault and that they must be able to get through it and discuss it and the issues that would evolve. Because unfortunately, if it's an experience that is pleasurable but illicit, it does cause repercussions in the future. And it could be, as it turned out to be, that the molester himself had been molested as a child, and now he carried out that behavior because it is what he was accustomed to and it was a pleasurable experience. And the same molester, as he grew older, happened to be sent to me one day by the court system to be given certain injections to control his desires. And he said to me, you know, it's very easy for me because I just do it mit der Heimische and not mit der Goyim, because mit der Heimische, everybody clams up and no one says anything and they never press charges, so I can get away with it. And that is very, very, very sad reflection of society, that we don't cover up these, that we do cover up these things. Is not Lashon Hara. It is not maestering on somebody. But if somebody has molested somebody else, it is imperative that both people get help and it be reported to the proper authorities. So when it comes to camp, every camp should have a plan of action that if something inappropriate happens or is suggested or it's alleged, then a protocol is in taken into account, they follow the guidelines, they investigate, and if there is any truth to it, the counselor or the individual is sent home and goes for help. You cannot cover this up. We are not blind. We cannot be like ostriches. Things, unfortunately, do happen. So the kid has to be told in a non-threatening manner, in a non-anxiety-provoking manner, that when you're in camp and if you're going to go to the bathroom with somebody else, make sure that there's no fondling, there's no touching. Do not sit on the counselor's lap. Do not lie in the same bed together. Because we have certain gedorim, we have boundaries. This is the way, as a Jew, this is the way we behave. We treat each other with respect. We treat our bodies with respect. If somebody wants to or has done something to you and you're making you feel uncomfortable in what they're doing, then you tell them, you know, I don't like this, I'm not comfortable, and you try and get out of the situation, or you report it to the counselor or even to the head of the camp. If things get to the point where somebody is trying to do something to a child and they're alone, I always say to the kid, you know, what you do if you're in such an uncomfortable situation, scream. Even if nothing happens, either the person will be so alarmed and scared they'll run away, but if something does happen and the kid screamed, then they've told me that they felt empowered. They did something. They did an action. They didn't feel that they were just a total victim, but they were able to try and do something to prevent it happening, even if, God forbid, it does happen. And that's to the benefit of the child at large, that they know that they were able to try and prevent it. Otherwise, they feel guilty and that they did something wrong. And the kids have to be told that if somebody does do something or says something inappropriate or wants you to watch something on their iPhone that's inappropriate, you're allowed to tell somebody about it, and especially your parents have to know everything because your parents are your best friends. They're there to protect you. They love you. They care for you. It is not Lashon Hara. You're not getting somebody else into trouble. You're not doing rechilas. Any of these, all these arguments are used. Don't tell. If you tell, you're being negative. It's an avera. It's not an avera. This is to prevent any future problems, and it's to save other children. So if kids understand that what they're doing is correct and they're saving other people, then hopefully some of the nonsense that might and shouldn't occur will be prevented.
So we're speaking to the great Paisik, Rabbi David Cohn, and Shalom Aleichem to the Rav.
Aleichem Shalom.
Rabbi David, let me ask you a question. 100 Rabbanim, starting in Chicago, was under Rabbi First, came out with a psak that's saying that if somebody accuses somebody of molestation, a child accuses an adult of molestation, they should go to the police. There have been murmurs disagreeing, saying, no, you go to a Rav. Tell us, what is halacha psuka, in your opinion?
You leave out the word psuka. In my humble opinion, this manifesto is nothing new, because I've been paskening this for the last 20 years, let us say, as Rav Avogel, because a tremendous amount of shilas would come my way. I know many Rabbanim who just send it my way, and I pasken one should go to the authorities directly. There were one or two cases where people were over-exaggerating about the molestation of a parent to a child, and I told them, don't report this. But in every other case, to my recollection, I said, go to the authorities. You don't have to ask a shiva. Again, here we have again a state law that says that the person who is a mandated reporter can't ask a clergyman. This is again against the Constitution. There's no one out to fight it, but there's no doubt in my mind it's against the Constitution. They can't make such a law that if my religious training says I have to ask a Rav whether I can report it, they can't make such a law. They're just doing it because they're reacting. They used to be a person who was a mandated reporter who didn't do it, didn't even get a slap on the wrist. And then when they saw what molestation can do, they went the other way. This other way is unconstitutional. We just need to see people to fight it. I am very tolerant of people who will ask Rabbanim. I am not tolerant of Rabbanim who don't know how to eat this thing. You'll pardon the put it in quotes. They don't know what molestation is all about, and that's why perhaps they feel that it's nothing. So it's being slowly turned around. But to me, this hetamei Rabbanim is nothing new whatsoever.
So
I don't
why
know
isn't
who's
it a
sponsoring
it. Why isn't it a Shiloh of Masira?
For many, many reasons. Start with A. We are not allowed, let's forget a moment about being Moisa, someone, Lahariga. It's a Beferish Adina Shulchan Aruch, black and white, that a Mitzah is Hatzibel.
Shin Peches, right?
Yeah, Shin Peches and Machai Shemesh, but I think it may be Siftes, but it's Beferish. Mitzah Hatzibel, you give him over to the authorities not to kill him. Lani Estati, we have no right Bisman Hazeh to be Ma'anish someone. My opinion is that anyone who is guilty of molestation, that's guilty by Umdana, and incidentally there's a Ramah that Ketanim, Takonas Hagoinim, that Ketanim Anemon.
As on Nashim, the Ramah, Nashim, where there's no Anashim Nimtza.
Right, that's
the, the two of the Shailomeshiv on that. Yeah.
But it's Ramah. So right. I'm not saying, the Ramah goes for Gabi Hilchus Seidus. By us, Umden is enough. If the Umden is that what these children are saying is true, according to the Umden, we have to not punish. We're not allowed to punish. But we have to be Matzil Hatzibur. So I believe that every molester should be given a life sentence, unless we know from evidence that the person changed before we sat on the trial, before we made this judgment. Because to protect the tzibur, he'll be out in a year, 2 years, 3 years. Why? How are we protecting the tzibur in 3 years? The goyim look at this as a punishment. We're not punishing. We have to protect our children. And because of this, I feel life sentences should be given for molestation, except if everyone will testify that they see a tremendous change, then under certain circumstances, they should let the person out of prison. So that's ABC, that Mitzar HaTzibur, these people are. I believe that those Rabbonim that were always very lax and were against paskening, that a Mitzar HaTzibur should be given over to the authorities, it's simply because they didn't know what molestation meant. 40 years ago, top psychologists didn't begin to know what molestation did because there was no feedback from those who were molested. But as the evidence became more and more that there are so many people who are suffering, and some of them for life, that their joie de vivre was taken out of them. People have no more simchas achayim, and many of them for life. When it became more and more realized that this is happening, so then we understood, hey, there's such a big molestation. But these rabbanim don't know the effects of molestation. That's the only way, I don't want to use the word justify, but that I can understand how they could say, forget about it, it's nothing. I can't justify what they did in any way if they would really know what a molestation does. So this whole manifesto of 100 rabbanim, I don't know who's sponsoring it. I have my chashashos v'dayla maven, what this is all about and how it all came about. But it's, to me, as we say in the Gemara, poshut kebeya sebekutcha, just like you're allowed to eat an egg that's finished in a milchika dip, albeit it comes from a chicken. We all know that's mutter. The Gemara wants to say that maybe it's not even called a hiroa because it's so poshut. So the Gemara gives this as an example. This is poshut to me, that knowing what we know today, it's poshut that you go to the authorities. Rabbanim are not trained like psychologists. Even among psychologists, one needs special training in this area called molestation. So they, before when they have a case against the person, there is consultation. The person is giving a fair chance to defend himself. But certainly, certainly, we have to give these a mitzari at Seber. This is the way we have to react. This is step one in why we are obligated to do so. And a person who doesn't do so is over an avera called leisamer al dam reyecha. There's no doubt in my mind.
And this is the answers to last week's halacha riddle. We had many, many responses, probably more than 100, and we've chosen sort of like a raffle of those who we believe got the correct responses.
Hello, thank you very much for your show again. It's good to hear you back. To answer the weekly riddles, I think for the first riddle, how come within Hiddur Mitzvah you have the Talis also, and you know, you want to find the Bais or something like that? So it could be. We find the halacha Shulchan Aruch that if you buy a talis, you don't make shachianu until you put tzitzis on it. So, the shaila is, why not? Mr. Brewer says, it's far over there that it depends if you're able to use it or you're not able to use it. So, the problem is that Rufager says, if you buy you have new kelim from an akum and need tefillah, very clear that maybe you do need to say shachianu right away. So chayra, it's not shvar in this mishnah berurah necessarily. It's not a theory to the ikar svar akapanim, because kanzain that's more than just a shvar of being royal and last. So if you're able to use it, tefillah is just a tnai b'halma. Hashem came, but it's snapshot that is this hachshir that you do to the baget. Says it's only mutter to wear a baget with tzitzis. After I was saying that it's only mutter to wear a baget with tzitzis. Hashem is complete the baget is a chelik me'inyan hamitzah. And kinir for anyone, whoever learns any of the nyanim about tzitzis, and kinir it's davar pasha that the baget is a chelik me'inyan tzitzis. Plus the bias is not a chelik me'inyan mezuzah. I think that would be very chilek. The baguette is made in a tzitzis, surrounded by the baguette. And we know kairich taina that the baguette is called the tzitzis. You wouldn't have to put it on tzitzis b'chol. So kairich chol, the baguette is made in the guf ha-mitzvah. But since even if the baguette itself is not a mitzvah, the mitzvah is putting tzitzis on it, but the baguette is a chilek of the guf ha-mitzvah. The middle of the passes to have hider on the baguette, as opposed to bias, and this is the bias is not a chilek of the guf ha-mitzvah. The bias is just what's mechuyev in the mitzvah mezuzah. But regarding the second question, what's the difference between if you take off tzitzis, you have to make a new bracha, and you walk out of the sukkah for a short period, still in the middle of your yeshiva sukkah, then you don't have to. I think it's, this is more of an arichas, so I won't speak it all out, but I think it's an aspire from the sukkah, the different shittas in when you make the bracha, when you mechuyev to make a bracha, and not only when you're mechuyev to make a bracha, but when you are mechuyev, at what point are you mechuyev to make a bracha? And especially the nidainim in the rishainim, the sugya of birch satayra, and you don't have a haftik of birch satayra, and the handle took over there also. The kinira, the svar that comes out mitech the sugya, is that sukkah, it's not just a maisim mitzvah of sitting down in the sukkah, eating in the sukkah. It's not the guf maisa of eating. It's the dira, it's the living in the sukkah. How do you live in the sukkah? You live in the sukkah through eating in the sukkah. You live in the sukkah through sleeping in the sukkah. And those are the main, that's how, to use the terms, that's how you kaveh your dira. And it's beferish in the sukkah. I'm sure this is what you're coming from also. So then, of course, it comes out that it's simple. The kash doesn't start. Because tzitzis, the mitzvah is wearing a bag with tzitzis. That is the mitzvah. So you take it off, so now you stop doing the mitzvah. You put it back on, you have to take another bracha. Mashenkin besoka, as long as it won't buy the hefsek and that kviyas of dira, so as long as you're still living there, even if you're not papayal doing the mitzvah of yeshiva soka, as long as as your kviyas is still around, so it's not a hefsek, and in the middle, you don't have to make a new bracha.